Hello and welcome to Saving Animals with Blank Park Zoo. I'm Ryan Bickle. On today's show, we have Michelle Miller, the Stellenbosch University National Research Chair in Animal TB, located in South Africa, and she's interested in the conservation of everything big and gray, she says. So welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Ryan. I'm really pleased to be here this morning with you.
And you're here. You're going to be speaking at Blank Park Zoo tonight, and so we're very interested in hearing what you have to say. But tell us, how did you get started caring about rhinos and elephants and hippos?
Well, I'm actually originally from Wisconsin with a farm background, and I've always loved large animals. I remember as a child watching all sorts of wildlife programs on TV and just fell in love with especially the African wildlife, like the elephants and the rhinos.
You know, it's funny, every time we have someone in here and talk to them about conservation, I always ask that question, how did you get started? And it's always, when I was a child, something happened. And a lot of times it's, I lived outside, we lived in a wooded area, and I loved playing outdoors, and that's how I got interested in saving animals. And even with you, you saw elephants and rhinos on TV and learned to love them. So even as a child, that's where a lot of our opinions are formed. So
and especially I remember my family taking us to our local zoo in Milwaukee, mm-hmm. and just falling in love. That was the highlight of, you know, especially our summer vacations when we could spend the day at the zoo.
Well, and that's why zoos are important, because they're that connection to wildlife that, you know, otherwise we wouldn't know much about elephants or rhinos because they're not native to North America.
And I think it's really important that, you know, children of all ages have access to zoos, because quite honestly, that's where we do fall in love, is having that personal connection with animals and seeing them and watching them and learning how important they are in our lives and in our world.
So you got started in Wisconsin, and you made your way to South Africa. How did that come about?
Well, I always wanted to be a veterinarian, and like you said, you fall in love with animals, and of course you want to help them. And there's a lot of ways we can do that, but my path was I wanted to be a veterinarian, and I studied to be a veterinarian at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And then I also did some graduate work in veterinary science to get some more training in diseases. And after that, I finished my training. I actually went to the San Diego Zoo and did my postdoctoral training there. And of course, that really solidified my love for zoos and zoo animals, and knowing that each of us can make a difference.
That's really great. So tell us about rhinos. Since we have a rhino here, we have a pair of rhinos and a baby rhino right now. Tell us what's happening to rhinos in Africa.
Well, I think that's such an important topic to cover, especially now. And our talks this afternoon for the students and for the visitors here at the zoo tonight will be about rhino conservation, the past, the present, and how we can affect the future. And I think that each of us sometimes feel maybe a little bit helpless if we're living in the Midwest. How can we influence conservation, especially in another continent like Africa? But if we take the time to really understand these animals, understand some of the pressures that they're undergoing, both, you know, diseases or how we manage them in captivity and also in the wild, that we can feel like we can help influence that future. And especially, for instance, the black rhinos that you have here are such an important conservation story. They were once very widespread through sub-Saharan Africa, and now they're only present in very fragmented, small populations. And their numbers went quite low, but through conservation efforts, they're estimated to be about 5,000 black rhinoceros in total in Africa today. So that's a good story to tell, is that we can make a difference in trying to preserve these populations. And especially, I think that with zoos, what we're doing is we're learning about these animals, things that would be very difficult to do studying them in the wild, learning about their health, their breeding, their all their different needs. And that can be, again, communicated to all the people that visit here, the Blank Park Zoo, and you know, just by even visiting the zoo, you're helping with conservation, help support conservation in the wild.
That's absolutely right. Every visit to Blank Park Zoo, a portion of what you pay for admission or at the gift shop or whatever goes to help animals in wild populations. There's been a lot in the news recently about the northern white rhino and how the last male has passed away and there's only two females left, and I hear they're past reproductive age. Some people are trying to save genetic material, and I think those efforts are good. But right now with the black rhino, there's a population that if we use good methods and conservation techniques, there's actually a chance that we won't have to go to those extreme measures as with the northern white rhino.
I absolutely agree with that. I think, again, conserving animals in their native habitat is so important, so that you know, people that can value them in Africa and learn the value of conservation and benefit from it. That's one very important thing, and also in terms of just the genetic diversity. When you get down to very few animals, you lose that genetic diversity, and then they're more potentially susceptible to diseases or other problems, reproductive problems, etc. So, you know, of course, everything we do to try and conserve animals in the wild is extremely important, but it's somewhat out of our control. And therefore, that's where zoos play an important role in also helping maintain that genetic diversity. And if, you know, we have a worst case scenario, some of those animals may actually be valuable in reintroducing wild populations.
Yeah, it'd be great that someday to hear that, hey, the natural areas are safe enough for rhinos to go back, or offspring of rhinos in captive populations to go back. Could you talk about some of the threats, maybe the human threats and non-human threats of rhinos?
So, as you can imagine, rhinoceros need a lot of space and a lot of natural vegetation to feed and those type of things. So male rhinoceros maintain territories. So trying to put too many animals into a small space can actually lead to problems with animals fighting, injuring each other, and even potentially killing each other. So we need to have wide open, large spaces to maintain a viable population. So that's one of the things that is actually a threat, is as the human population grows and they're demanding more space for living, for agriculture, for those type of needs, we're putting pressures on these areas and we're squeezing these animals together, which means we can't keep as many animals in that specific habitat. So that's one of the threats that humans impose on rhinoceros. Another one, of course, has been in the news, is poaching. So that's one of the most immediate threats for these animals to future extinction. And the poaching has really escalated since about 2007, 2008. And in the Kruger National Park, where I'm based, on average, about two rhinos a day are poached and killed.
Wow. And when you think 5,000 black rhinos and you're losing two a day, doing the math on that is not a pleasant thought. What are some of the other things that, say, in Kruger National Park, conservationists are doing to help protect them?
So there's been a great international support as well as local support for protecting the rhinoceros. Of course, one of the immediate things is to train field rangers to be able to track, locate, identify animals to keep them safe and to keep poachers at bay. There's been a lot of technology in the recent years. They now have rapid response teams that consist of specially trained rangers with dogs that can track poachers, and they can actually use a helicopter to bring those immediately to a site if, for instance, there's a suspected incursion by poachers, which is great, but sometimes that's a little bit after the fact. So what we need to do is do a lot of outreach to communities to show them the value of conservation. We also need to educate people in other countries, especially in Asia, where rhinoceros horn is looked at as a status symbol and also used in traditional medicine. And so because the belief is that it has a lot of potency, people will pay a lot of money for those horns, even though, of course, we know scientifically it has no value. That material is the same material, keratin, that's found in your fingernails or in your hair. So we need to really do a lot of education and outreach to help minimize the demand for rhino horn.
And one of the things I always hear is you know, maybe it's in other parts of the world that the demand is really high for rhino horn or ivory tusks. But I've also heard that United States is the number two consumer of ivory. And so the problem is right here in our own backyard as well. And there was a court case in Iowa not too long ago about importation of a rhino horn. And so these things do happen. You think maybe they don't happen here in Iowa, but yes, they do happen here in Iowa. Let's turn to elephants. Tell us a little bit about interactions you've had with elephants and some stories about elephants.
Well, elephants, of course, are very unique. And I think that one of the things, again, is appreciating elephants in the zoos. And it's very interesting that, for instance, African and Asian elephants behave very differently, just like white and black rhinoceros.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit of the differences between Asian and African elephants.
So Asian elephants have been domesticated for literally thousands of years and have had close interactions with people. And they tend to be a little bit more docile, a little bit more forgiving than the African elephants. So that's one of the reasons you tend to see them more commonly working elephants in range countries and those type of thing. The African elephants, like the black rhinos, tend to have a little bit more fiery personalities, a little bit less forgiving. So you don't ever want to startle an elephant, either an Asian or an African.
What are the pressures on elephants?
So again, the pressures on elephants is they actually need a lot of space. And so we need to, again, the human pressures are they don't have space. They're being confined. And so oftentimes they do leave the parks because they interfere with eating crops or sometimes going to villages. And there's that human-elephant conflict, which then, of course, local people, you know, if their crops are destroyed or if their house is destroyed, sometimes retaliate against these animals. And, of course, then the ivory trade, as you've mentioned, is a big threat as well. So I think people need to understand that we need to live in our natural world and try and find novel ways where we can all exist in a little bit of harmony. But realizing that, again, whether it's elephants, rhinos, or people, we're all kind of fighting for space and resources.
Yeah, and sometimes it's hard for us here to sort of grasp how much space they need. And the other thing that goes through my mind is I understand if an elephant or an animal is destroying crops, what that does to those people. So I understand, the frustration and the side of the person. And so it's not just me standing, you know, thousands of miles away saying, don't do this, do this. I understand there's a conflict. And many times they have come to solutions that are very easy that allow for both to coexist.
Absolutely. And there's some really novel techniques that they're trying. For instance, it's been shown that elephants don't like bees. So some of the villages actually are kind of trying a new industry by creating honey, which again is a resource either for sale or for use by villages, and also by having the beehives around the periphery of the village that the elephants have been shown to kind of want to avoid those areas. So I think it's a creative way where it's a win-win situation for people and animals.
Hippos. You're interested in hippos as well. Tell us about hippos.
Well, hippos are very interesting. I think people underestimate these animals. They're actually quite smart. And I worked at the Disney Animal Kingdom for quite a few years. And I was surprised, I actually learned myself, how smart they can be. You can actually train them. So as we know, when you have animals in a zoo, it's very important that we try to work with those animals to do exams and to, when we have to treat them or give them medication. And these hippos are incredibly smart. You can teach them, just like a dog, to open their mouth so you can examine their teeth. You can train them to move into a chute. So if you need to x-ray their toe has a bit of an infection or some damage, and they're very tolerant and they're very smart.
What is the conservation status of hippos? We don't have hippos at Blank Park Zoo, although a lot of people confuse hippos and rhinos for some reason. But what is the, tell us about that, because that's not something we talk about a whole lot here since we don't have hippos.
So there are actually two different types of hippos. They're the common or the Nile hippo or the river hippo, which is the one most of us think of as the big animal. And those animals are found primarily associated with rivers or other inland water systems in Africa. They are actually very social animals, so they're a lot like elephants that way. And the interesting thing is they come out and they graze at night. So that's where some of the conflict is with people, is when they get startled at night. And believe me, they can run a lot faster than people. We've done some work to learn how to immobilize hippos, which are very, very challenging, so that we can sometimes move them if they're in conflict with people. And it has amazed me how quick they can move.
Yeah, because you wouldn't want to come upon a hippo. That would be like coming upon a lion or something like that.
And they say that hippos may actually kill more people in Africa than lions, for instance. And again, it's that conflict because people are using the same resources, or people are in a boat and it's disturbed the hippos and they might actually capsize the boat or something like that. But again, these animals are... they're just trying to protect their own areas as well. So we have to take a, I think, the perspective of sharing our environment with yeah. animals.
What do hippos eat?
So hippos actually are grazers. So they will come out on the shore and they eat grass for the most part. On rare occasions, people have seen them actually attack other mammals, but it's not usually because they want to eat them. It's because they're protecting their territory.
You must have some great stories of animal interactions. And did you have anything you could share with us?
Absolutely. I think one of the things, it never ceases to amaze me how that you see something new with animals all the time. So again, we often will interact with animals when we're out in the field. We're doing research, or if we have to capture animals to translocate them to another place. And one of the things that's really interesting is, for instance, if you're working with elephants, a family group of elephants, the bond between the family group is so strong that if you need to immobilize one animal, you oftentimes have to immobilize the whole group. And we've seen, for instance, if we immobilize an adult cow or female in the group, those babies will ferociously defend their mom against a helicopter and a group of people that are coming at them. So, and they're, even though they may be small, they're very quite strong. So,
oh, I bet. Yeah.
So sometimes we've actually been chased by baby elephants away from their mothers. So we take a lot of precautions. And you see that, again, the bonds in family groups of animals, even between a mother rhinoceros and her calf. If she's been chased off, she'll come back with a fury. So we always make sure that we have people watching on the periphery.
Yeah, I bet a rhinoceros, if startled, can charge. I've seen, you know, walking by the rhinoceros at Blank Park, sometimes, you know, if they get startled, they'll come right up. And even though there's a big barrier there, it's still quite an experience. So
absolutely. And the interesting thing is, too, if you startle an animal, oftentimes these animals are living in the bush. So they don't necessarily rely on their eyesight, but they rely on their smell. And we've had instances, for instance, where we might have startled a group of elephants when we're on foot. And you can see that they put their trunk in the air, they're sniffing, even though they should be able to see you, they don't. And using that trunk, they can find you and chase you around a bush mm-hmm. or up a tree. So you always have to be on your toes when you're out in the field, because you never know what you're going to come across.
Since you're the chair in Animal TB, maybe we should ask some questions about that. Tell us, are there differences between animal TB and human TB? And in some cases, human TB can be transferred back and forth to some animals. So give us, I guess, a high overview of what you do there.
Absolutely. That's right, Ryan. I think one of the biggest things that we need to be aware of is TB is one of those diseases that can go back and forth between humans and animals. And my primary focus is actually looking at the impact of this disease in wildlife. So, for instance, we have actually found human TB in a wild African elephant. We don't really understand how it got there, but this is just an example of the indirect but very significant consequences that humans can have on animals. And so it probably had been in that animal for years before it finally killed it, but it could have been a simple act of maybe leaving some contaminated garbage or food that this animal came across and became infected.
Wow. And so is it a huge problem with animals, TB, in wild populations?
Yeah. So in many parts of the world, here even in the U.S., we have TB in elk, occasionally in bison, and in white-tailed deer that again, can present a threat to both human health mm-hmm. and also livestock health. And because this can move back and forth, it's something that we should at least be aware of. And again, the consequences of not keeping an eye on these problems. In South Africa, just in the Kruger Park alone, we have found TB in more than 16 species of animals in the park, wildlife. And because it's a very large and complex ecosystem, it's something that we can't really manage or control, but we need to monitor and make sure that we minimize the risk of spread to other areas.
Maybe we should talk about what is TB, because I think a lot of Americans probably think, well, that's something that's something that has been, you know, eradicated maybe in the United States. And for the most part, it's not a major problem. But could you tell us what the disease actually is?
So tuberculosis actually can be caused by a group of related bacteria. So there are organisms that primarily infect humans and organisms that affect different species of animals. But these can cross back and forth between the hosts. And it wasn't that long ago that literally in the United States in the 1900s, tuberculosis was a leading cause of death in the population. And most of it, a lot of it came from cattle. So that's why the Department of Agriculture and other groups have had a tuberculosis surveillance and eradication program to minimize the threat to human health as well as to animal health. And around the world, TB still exists in both livestock and wildlife, and again, can present threats to humans. And human TB is a major disease. Again, it's the leading cause of death in the world in humans by an infectious disease. So about 1 million cases a year of people that die from TB. So it's not a disease that's gone away, although it's at very, very low levels in the U.S. thanks to good human health and animal health programs.
Well, thanks for that information. We have only a couple minutes left, and so I want to just take this opportunity. If you had to tell our audience just one thing that they could do, maybe in their local environments or something to help out animals in other parts of the world, what should they do?
Well, I think one of the big things is awareness. So the first step is visit your local zoo, attend seminars, read on and Google questions about conservation and about species you have interest in. And I think having conversations like we're having today increases awareness and then also increases activism, again, by visiting your local zoo. Zoos support conservation in the field, making people aware of the threats that we have to wild animals. And again, even conservation in your backyard with your native wildlife.
If people want to learn more about you or your research, is there a website you have that you could share right now?
Absolutely. If you go to Stellenbosch University and look up the Animal TB Group, I'm sorry, I don't have the website memorized, but I think that we can probably create a link on the Blank Park Zoo.
All right. Well, very well. Thanks so much for visiting with us today. And even though you're talking tonight, by the time our listeners hear this, it'll be already be over with. But very good information, and we wish you the best. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Ryan.
And if you want to learn more about Blank Park Zoo, head over to our website, blankparkzoo.com. And you can learn all about our events and fun things that you can do at the zoo. Of course, take a glance at our YouTube channel, and you can see all sorts of fun videos there as well. Well, that's all the time we have right now, so tune in next time for Saving Animals with Blank Park Zoo.